Ben Oni, and this week I'm talking on the theme of a Christian lifestyle in an age of anxiety. Yesterday we looked at health and disease, and today we'll be looking at stress and well-being and the creative tension involved in these dualities, which I think is what makes life so interesting and source of problems, but also the source of a lot of opportunities. In Minnesota, I know a lot of you are from there, when I write HHH, what does it stand for? Hubert Horatio Humphrey. And I was thinking last night that one thing we might want to do this week is to have every session Holden Hug for Health. So I invite you to all stand up, turn to someone you either know or don't know, and give one another a big hug here. Talking about stress from a sort of a general point of view, and then spend the last 20-30 minutes looking at a Christian perspective on stress. With the handouts too, I understand we ran out. If you're with a spouse and you don't need both, maybe you can spread them around. I will be writing some of this on the board, so don't worry if you didn't get a handout. Let's start by brainstorming and putting on the board some ideas about what stress is for you. Stress is kind of a funny thing. We all feel we know what stress is, and yet there are some hidden factors and some difficulties that many of us have in dealing with it. If we all understand it, why can't we deal with it adequately so we don't have a lot of the problems associated with stress? But let's put on the board what stress is for some of us here. Just shout them out and I'll write them down.
Pressure.
Okay.
Frustration. Tension. Rejection. Anxiety.
Okay.
Worry.
Worry.
Anger.
Fear. Now, let's brainstorm a few ways that we cope with some of these stressors.
Exercise.
Prayer.
Food.
Sleep.
Sorry.
Crying.
Kid crying, solitude.
Sleep.
No laughter. No words.
Okay, laughter. Someone said smoking.
Keeping it inside, I don't know what you're trying.
Okay, stuffing.
Planning ahead.
Planning ahead.
Martha said thinking.
The Bible.
Okay, Bible.
Sleep.
I think we got that.
Medication.
Okay, medication.
Work.
Good thing I'm short, I can get right down. What, work? Play.
Music.
Music.
Creativity.
Sharing time with a friend.
Writing.
Well, we can go on and on, use up the whole board. The point is that there are hundreds of stressors out there, but at the same time, there are hundreds of ways that we cope. Now, as you look at the list of coping mechanisms, what do you see?
Well, you see good ones and bad ones.
Okay, you see good ways of coping and bad ways of coping. Some of the bad ways of coping do what? Cause more stress. Right. So part of the problem isn't that we don't know what stress is, because we do. Living is stressful. But for some of us, we don't deal with it, and so it becomes distress, bad stress. And some of the ways that we cope with bad stress or distress just perpetuates the problems. And so the art or the trick is maybe for us to learn good coping skills so that we can deal with life stresses in an adequate way, so they don't build up and don't become excessive, because that's when the body starts wearing down, we have a lot of the problems. Okay.
Comment, and they're not stressors. A year or so ago in our adult education class in Sunday school, we had a series of things, and one of them dealt with stress. And it talked about a lot of events in life that cause stress, and there was a rating scale and so on. And it listed just numerous things. Death, moving, having a daughter married, having even a birthday, just all kinds of events of life that have some degree of stress associated with them, and then a scale with various points associated with them.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. That's called the social readjusting rating scale, and if we have enough time today or tomorrow, I was going to give that to you. It's a list of a number of different events that trigger stress, and it was developed by two researchers at the University of Washington, and they've tested it on thousands, 12,000-15,000 people, and found that people that score high have a 90% chance of becoming ill during the year, because if stress is not relieved, the body wears out and you become ill. And they found this to be a fairly reliable instrument in determining your current level of stress. So if we have time either today or tomorrow, I'll give these out, and you can use this as an assessment of your current level. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. The other thing is, if you want at any point just to break in and comment, feel free to do that. I appreciate, you know, your comments as we're going along. Okay, I mentioned that there's good stress. That's called loose stress. That's good. We want to hold on to that. And there's distress, which is bad, which we want to let go of. And in the dictionary, stress has...
What's your good stress?
Pardon? Good stress?
Yeah,
it's EU. Stress.
Oh, EU. Oh, yes.
Yeah. In our country, when we hear the word stress, we think of it as being bad, right? But stress is neither good nor bad. It depends on how we deal with it. In fact, we need stress. The only people with no stress have an electrocardiogram that looks like this. Living is full of stress, and it's the source of creativity. A lot of neat things happen if you can channel your stress in positive, creative ways. It's when we don't that it becomes distress. So I want you to not think of stress as being bad, but it's excessive unrelieved stress that we don't deal with that then becomes distress. That's the bad stuff that we want to try to cope with. Each of us has our own unique level of stress. If you think of an analogy, might be a guitar or violin. If the strings are too slack, we don't get sound or music, do we? Or it's rather flat. Likewise, if we tighten it up too high, it doesn't sound right either, does it? Each string has to be at the proper tension level to do what it's supposed to do. And there are 5-6 strings, and each of them have to be at the right tension level for the instrument to sound the way it's supposed to sound. And each of us in here, we all have our own different tension levels. It may be different from me than it is from you. Well, in fact, it is. And we have to know when we're too slack as well as when we're too tight. One way to think about that, we'll be coming back to these, by the way, is to put it on a bell-shaped curve. Over here, it stands for your behavior or how you're feeling. Illness would be down here. And if you have too little stress in your life, if you're just sort of depressed all the time, kind of blah, you're apt to get ill, and your performance will not be very good. It'll be down in a low level. Likewise, if you have too much stress, the same thing happens, that your behavior, your attitude, your performance goes down. So too little stress or too much stress both create problems for us. And people that have too much stress have to learn how to say no to being on this committee, to doing that. A lot of people that have heart attacks or who die when they have to replace them at work, they find maybe it took 2 or 3 people to do the job that this person was doing. Some of us are very compulsive people. We like to perform. We like to do well. And we overwork ourselves, okay? And that creates too much. So these people have to learn how to say no once in a while and feel that's okay. What do the people over here have to learn what to say?
Yes.
These people have to get more involved. They're just kind of floating along. I mean, they have to get out and do some stuff, say yes to joining this or joining that. Because they're performing at a very low level also. So what we want to do is to try to find the right amount of stress for each of us where we're performing at our best abilities. Not too little, not too much. Another analogy is the rubber band. Too little, right? Just right. Too much? I won't do it. Might hurt my fingers. Okay? So think of a guitar string or a viol or a rubber band and try to discover what your own unique level of stress is when you're performing at your best. We all have signals when stress is building up too high. If we eat too much, yesterday I shared the fact that I tried to get rid of my sweet tooth by eating a lot of candy, and it didn't work, and I got sick. If you eat too much, you get sick. Likewise, if you're under too much stress, what are some things, some signals that your body tells you, hey, you know, start saying no?
Headache.
Fatigue.
Backaches.
Okay, high blood pressure.
Short temper.
Sure.
voicelessness.
Okay, you can't sleep at night.
Irritability.
You're irritable. Okay, these are signals. Your body is saying to you, hey, there's something wrong here. And if we don't heed them, what's going to happen? You die. Yeah, it's very simple. Eventually, you will die.
Sooner.
Sooner, yeah. We all will. Yeah, life is 100% fatal, I believe. Okay. I'd like now to explain the stress response. Some of you were able to get the sheet, and I know we ran out, so I'm going to put it on the board and run through it. Some of you couldn't hear this, but many saw the 70-year warranty down at the bottom and realized she was on borrowed time already. But it is true that we've been put together, in a sense, with a 70-year warranty, and a lot of us have to go in for repairs many times before we reach that point. And how we live our lives, the decisions we make in terms of what we eat and whether we exercise and how we deal with stress, will in fact determine whether we're going to blow out, or whether we're going to rust out, or whether we're going to burn out. People that kind of rust out are the ones that do too little. The ones that are going to blow out are doing too much. And the ones that are working at performance may be those that burn out. I don't know, maybe they kind of tend over here. But we can kind of determine how it is we want to end our lives by how we live our lives now. The other thing to remember is that what we do, you don't just have a heart attack, do you? Okay. Or you don't just have a divorce. You don't just develop high blood pressure or ulcers. These things, these conditions, you work on for many years, 5, 10, 15 years, till finally the body just says, enough of this. And then you have to, you know, be flat on your back. And for some people, it takes that dramatic event before they will start making some changes in how they're living their life. But it doesn't have to be that way. You can make the choices, the decisions, right now while you're still healthy. Just like yesterday, we talked about going up that continuum, normal health. You can get up here and stay in the optimum range so that you're minimizing these chances of some of these problems occurring. Okay, the stress response. Up at the top of the sheet, there are a number of stressors. And we all mentioned a number of them here. I'll just write some down. Time, our work, for some family, change. And then there are, as we've said, hundreds of others that you share. Now these are called stressors. In and of themselves, they aren't stress. Because we assign meaning to these stressors and this determines whether they're going to be stressful in our life or not. Let's use work as an example. Most of us work. Work can either be a source of enjoyment and satisfaction, or it can be a real drag, it can be boring, it can be a source of a lot of turmoil. Now, what makes it enjoyable for one and terrible for the next person?
Attitude.
Okay, attitude. It could be the meaning you assign to your job, what you're doing. Okay, and the same with family and with time, with dealing with that rush hour traffic. you know, if you're in an air-conditioned car and listening to Bach on a tape, using that time doesn't create a lot of stress for you. Whereas if it's hot and you're late getting home, it's been a hard day at the office, that is a lot of stress. Okay, so the stressors are just sort of there. It's part of living. And whether it becomes a stress or distress in your life is based on whether you attach meaning to it, whether it's important to you. Now, Hans Selye, who's done quite a lot of research on stress and wrote a book, Stress and Distress, he's sort of the father of research in distress. We have two books in the library noticed on it. Has said that when the body experiences stress, we have gas. And as you see on that, it stands for the Generalized Adaption Syndrome, which means the body kicks in. Okay. Certain things happen internally whenever you experience stress. It can be good events, marriage, birth of a child, moving to a new city that you're excited about, even coming to Holden. The body is reacting in different ways. Certain things happen. Your heart rate may increase. I know coming up on the bus, some of you probably the heart rate may increase. The ride up is free. The trip down is costly. But, you know, just riding on the boat and the expectation and coming up here, it was good stress, in a sense. You know, we were looking forward to it. And so one thing that happens is the heart rate increases, blood pressure may go up a little bit, the liver releases stored sugar, adrenaline is pumped into the body, the pupils sometimes enlarge. These are all internal developments that occur whenever you experience stress, good stress or bad stress. The body doesn't know whether marriage is good or bad. It just knows that something different's happening. Okay? And these things start happening. So, the body kicks in and certain biochemical reactions occur whenever we have this. And the body goes through three stages. The first is alarm. The second is resistance. And the third is exhaustion. Alarm. See, we were created this way for a very good reason. Our ancestors, when they were walking in the woods, a tiger may come upon them or a wild beast, and they had two responses, to fight or flight. You may have heard these two responses. Alarm. Adrenaline was pumped, sugar, muscle strength increased, and they could either fight that danger or they could run away from it. That's alarm. At work, you don't do something right. The boss comes in and chews you out. That's alarm. You want to fight or you'd like to run away, but you can't. It's not acceptable today, like it was for our ancestors. So we have to stuff that, and it's going to churn around in there, and if we don't deal with it, it's going to cause distress eventually. Because the body is under alarm. All these things have happened. Adrenaline is in the system, blood sugar's been released, the heart rate is up, the blood pressure is up, and it's going to sit there and stay there all day unless we can deal with it. And if you do it day after day after day after day, eventually you have a heart attack or other problems. Okay, alarm is the first stage. If it isn't dealt with, the body is a tremendous adaptive system, and that's why you can work on a heart attack for 10, 20 years before it really happens. The body will send it over to one of our systems and say, you work on this for a while, and when that wears out, then it'll transfer it to another system, and eventually, the body just becomes exhausted. Okay, are you all with me so far? Do you have questions up to this point? Yes.
Yeah, I have something that goes back of this, I suppose. I'm thinking of a girl who was very, very compulsive. Mm-hmm. And from childhood, that compulsion was there and grew and grew. And in the compulsiveness, she would not do anything unless she could excel.
Yes.
And possibly be above everybody else. But as a result, made her whole family kind of a messed up situation. Do you want to say a word about something that causes this compulsiveness that drives to stress? Or is that a little out of the blunt?
Well, I can comment on it, and others here may want to too. I think it's a very good point. There are certain, shall we say, personality traits or attitudes that do cause excessive stress. Lack of humor can be one, being a perfectionist, or being compulsive can be others. Being very rigid in terms of your attitude, you know, not being very flexible to things that come along. If you do have these personality traits, you probably aren't going to deal with life very well, and it's going to cause a lot of distress in your life as well as your family's. The point is, I think, that you can create stress by the meaning you assign to it. And if you can create stress, what also can you do? Remove it or destroy it. Okay. We have the power to say, to think mentally, whether this is stressful or not. And later on we'll talk about some Christian perspective that I think can really help us in terms of giving some meaning to our life, so that a lot of things that may cause stress don't have to.
And also, I suppose the way parents handle these things is going to make a difference as to how the children will react. Is that correct?
Modeling is how most of us picked up a lot of the things that we now do as we got older. And some of these ways of acting are good. Some of them aren't appropriate any longer. I shared yesterday how I stuffed a lot of feelings, and some of it was modeling my father. And it's taken me a long time, and I still work on it, to try to see that isn't necessarily the best way to respond to other people.
What about genetics? Certain types of people?
Okay, the question is, what about genetics? Are certain types of people born with certain personality types? There's debate on that. I used to think, no, that we all start out fresh and we can become who we want to become, in a sense. But the more I've worked with lots of different types of people, the more I think that there is some area for changing, but some people do have certain ways of
predetermined.
Yeah, that it's really, really hard to change.
There's a book by Julius Segal called The Child's Journey, and he talks about all the different things that influence a person to develop a certain way, and how a child becomes what he is. And he talks about genetics as, you know, one of many factors that influences the way the person develops.
Yes.
Pediatricians say you can tell in the hospital the squirmers and the placid child.
Well, those of you that have children, you know.
You can tell when you're pregnant.
Yeah. That's true.
Okay.
My family has an adopted 11-year-old boy who is, right now, you can see the difference between my brother and myself compared to Eric. He is highly intelligent, but he can't really perform well in sports. But that frustrates him to no end, because he keeps going, well, why did God give me brains when I wanted to be an athlete? And so the stress of an 11-year-old boy, and he's been raised in the same home environment, and yet totally different personalities from my brother and myself.
Well, I think this gets back to something very fundamental, that we have to learn how to accept ourselves and help our children accept ourselves. And of course they will if we accept them the way the Lord made them.
Yeah, we're all special and unique, like I was talking
right.
about yesterday, a gift.
But if we're dissatisfied with ourselves and there is nothing we can do about it, of course, we'll be full of stress our whole lives. Perfectionists suffer a great deal because, and they make everybody else suffer too around them.
And jumping ahead a little bit, you see, and that's what Christians believe, that we are accepted for who we are, mm-hmm. even though we aren't perfect, even though we're sinful, even though we maybe aren't a good athlete. It doesn't matter. We are accepted, and that is our source of hope and strength and trust and security. And if you do believe that, then a lot of these things aren't that important. I mean, they're still important, but they aren't a source of distress in your life.
The importance of our role models like that our children have in sports people, the eagerness to win and the fear of losing, fear of failure, would be important and affect a lot of our young people.
Oh, very much, sure. Yeah. We're a competitive society, and kids learn very early that you have to compete and win. It's important to win in life, and that causes a lot of unnecessary stress, I think. Yes?
I think that there's something else, too, environmentally, that we do as parents with our children. At least I think we try, with each progressive child, to improve ourselves as parents, and therefore I think that has a great deal to do with, at least I feel it has a great deal to do with the difference in my children's personalities. My kids are like night and day. You know, the one is just three sheets to the wind all the time, and the other one care less. And I think that has a great deal to do with my changing attitude as a parent, because I know I have changed.
Sure. Yeah, it's been a growing
That's
process
right.
for you.
Yes.
Well, they say that parents usually go by the book with their first child, and
That's
the
right.
second child is half by the book, half by common sense. And the third one, they just throw the book away.
Yeah, very true. Well, let me finish this up so we have some time to get into the Christian perspective. That's what I'm sure many of you are interested in. Okay, this general adaption syndrome, then, we cannot deal with it adequately, and it causes the distress. And eventually this leads to a number of diseases that I, the gastrointestinal, the cardiovascular, ulcers, as well as some mental dis-ease, nervous breakdowns, some of the behaviors that we talked about. These too can develop, becoming very withdrawn or possibly becoming very hyper, or certain behavior problems come out. This is ways that distress leads to disease down the road.
Cancer too.
Pardon?
Cancer too.
Cancer, yeah. We can also use this for good. And as I mentioned, this is our source of challenge and creativity and stimulation. And I suppose whether it becomes good stress or bad stress, we have to put in one more variable. That's our personality. But the point in all this is just to kind of give you a general overview of the stress response. What happens when you deal with stress? And the important factors, I feel, is that one, we assign meaning to life stressors. We determine whether they're very important to us, whether it's something we want to invest a lot of time and energy in. And then our personality takes it from there and determines to a large extent whether we're going to use this, being fired from work, as a source of stimulation to go out and get a better job, or whether we're going to just be real discouraged and start drinking to deal with it. I mean, you know, you can use it for copping out, or you can use it as a source of strength and stimulation to go on to bigger and better things. And here I think the personality of the person, how he grew up and
different influences he's had may determine, you know, which way the scale goes. But that's what makes it interesting, life interesting, because we all deal with it differently, and how we deal with something with one child will be different with the next. How we deal with something this year will be different next. We're just always kind of experimenting and trying different things. Sort of as a transition, I wanted you to think of, this is called Bodhi, a time when you had a $10 problem and you invested only 10 cents of adrenaline in it. In other words, it was a big problem, but you didn't get to, you didn't deal with it adequately. This is dealing with stress. You have a $10 problem and you only invest 10 cents worth of adrenaline in it. Then secondly, think of a time when you had a 10 cent problem and you invested $10 of adrenaline in it. And then finally, think of a time when you had a $10 problem and you invested $10 worth of adrenaline in it. Is that clear? See what I'm asking you to do? Just spend a few moments and then share it with someone next to you. And then when we come back, we'll go into a Christian perspective. This is a way to have you think about times when you've under-responded, times when you over-responded, and maybe one or two times when you hit the nail right on the head and you dealt with an issue properly.
What was the third one you gave me?
A $10 problem and you invested $10 worth of adrenaline on it. Is that clear to everybody? Do you understand what I'm asking you to do? Okay. Go into it more tomorrow when I talk on anxiety and peace. And the discussion you're having now, I really hated to break it up, but I think you could have gone the whole 15 minutes. And that's the type of thing that maybe you could carry over at lunch or you know, as you meet together during the day. Just use this as a way to have a conversation with someone. And while I'm thinking along those lines, someone mentioned to me yesterday they would like people to bring back those coat of arms so they could use that as a way of getting to know one another. So I invite you, you know, as you come back here and before the session start or after, if you have your coat of arms, just go up to someone and share that with one another. In Luke, there's a parable about a rich fool. A rich man had land which bore good crops. He began to think to himself, I don't have a place to keep all my crops. What can I do? This is what I'll do. I will tear my barns down and build bigger ones, where I will store the grain and all my other goods. Then I will say to myself, lucky man, you have all the good things you need for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and enjoy yourself. But God said to him, you fool, this very night you will have to give up your life. Then who will get all these things which you have kept for yourself? And Jesus concluded, this is how it is with those who pile up riches for themselves but are not rich in God's sight. Then Jesus said to the disciples, this is why I tell you, don't be worried about the food you need to stay alive or about the clothes you need for your body. Life is much more than these things. Look at the crows. They don't plant seeds or gather harvest. They don't have storage rooms or barns. God feeds them. You are worth so much more than birds. Which one of you can live a few more years by worrying about it? If you can't manage even a small thing, why worry about other things? Look how the wildflowers grow. They don't work or make clothes for themselves. But I tell you, even Solomon, as rich as he was, had clothes as beautiful as one of these flowers. It is God who clothes the wild grass, grass that is here today, gone tomorrow, burned up in the oven. Won't he be all the more sure to clothe you? How little faith you have. So don't be upset, always concerned about what you will eat and drink. Your Father knows you need these things. Instead, be concerned with his kingdom, and he will provide you with these things. I think ultimately or fundamentally, this whole question of stress and well-being is really a spiritual question. I think the core is a spiritual question. What is important to you? What is the purpose of life? What's the meaning of your life is a spiritual question. And what you attach meaning to is a spiritual issue. Where is your treasure? Where do you lay up your treasure? That's where your trust and your security and your hope lies. And for a lot of us, we feel more secure if we can have a lot of possessions, and we hanker after this and that, and we think that the more we have, the better we'll feel, the more secure we'll feel, and those of us that have tried that realize that it doesn't work. It isn't a source of security. We're still anxious, we're still troubled, we're still insecure, because our emphasis is not on the right treasure. And that's what the parable tells us about. And I think it's a beautiful parable, a beautiful story for us on how we deal with life and what that has to say about our well-being. This circle represents the self. And all of us have lots of different issues and hobbies and concerns within our universe. And often they don't seem to make any sense. We don't really know where we're going or where we've come from, and life has seemed to have lost any anchor. It has no meaning. All these things are just sort of floating around in our life, and we kind of take them as they come. Some of us like to play God too, and set ourselves above God, above Yahweh. We feel that we can handle things on our own, but quite often those of us who have played God realize it's a lonely place to be. And what we're continually saying is, yeah, but the Yahweh. Leave me alone, God. I'm not finished with myself yet. I still need a little more time to get my act together and to be the perfect person that I want to become. And so putting ourselves above Yahweh, while it is a temptation and a lot of us do it, ultimately is not going to help. It won't relieve this distress that we feel in our life, this sense of incompleteness and insecurity. There's a story of a lady who realized that, and she would pray every morning, "Dear God, send your healing powers into my life." And this went on for many years. She wasn't really a very nice lady, but she felt if she prayed to God and he would send her his healing powers, she would make it okay. This went on day after day, year after year. And one day, she said it again, "Dear God, send your healing powers into my life." And a voice came out, "I do, but you leak." Is an issue of faith. What's important is an issue of values, what we value. How we spend our time is a spiritual issue of our commitment. What we're willing to give up is an issue of surrender. And our goals is an issue of what we hope for. And these meanings are the locus of stress and the source of strength. What we attach meaning to ultimately, spiritually, determines whether our life is filled with stress or whether it's filled with well-being and peace.
Would you mind nodding to that idea?
Okay. The core issues in life, what's really important, are spiritual questions. What we believe in is a matter of faith. What's important in our life is our values, what we hold to be valuable. What we spend our time on is commitment. What we give up is surrender, and our goals and plans is a matter of what we hope to accomplish. And these are all spiritual concerns, spiritual issues. Now, some people are able to integrate these spiritual concerns. They sort of line up. They have their beliefs, their values, their attitudes, their hopes. They aren't all scattered around in their universe. It seems to make sense. There seems to be some integration. And the gap between these issues and here are how they do their plans and how they set their goals. And their life seems to make sense. It seems to have some meaning. It seems to be sort of integrated. They seem at peace with themselves and with the world. And to share something that is kept within the archives of Yale Divinity School, where I went to grad school, when a person is able to line up in that fashion, it's known as bingo. Someone who is integrated, who has laid up his treasures in the proper place, is at peace. Someone who has not grappled and come to rest with some of these issues has a life that is incomplete, and he's insecure, and everything's kind of scattered. And don't you see that this person is going to deal with life different than this person's going to deal with life, right? It just makes sense. And we get into this whole issue of being and doing. That this person who is integrated, the source of his motivation comes from who he is, a child of God. And he goes out and he works and has a family and goes on vacation and relates with people because of who he is as a Christian, as a person. Someone who isn't integrated and doesn't understand is out here doing, trying to make sense of who he is. And he's out here having a job, hoping to make sense of his life. He's out here grappling with a family, hoping to make sense of his life. You see the difference? Someone that is assured of his beinghood, his personhood, can go out and do things and deal with life in a manner that does not produce a lot of distress, because he's assured of what's important in life. Someone who doesn't have this assurance, who has laid up his treasures here and here and here and here to try to make meaning of his life, will always be insecure and incomplete. So that's the difference between the being and the doing. Well, there are 2 or 3 minutes left. I wanted to conclude with an article that appeared in the Minneapolis Star this January by Jim Klobuchar. Those of you who are from Minnesota have probably read him. You may have read this article. He writes, "The daily newspaper is not the appropriate vehicle for evangelism. It has resisted this activity. In fact, with an eager fortitude, it has done justice both to the codes of journalism and the territorial rights of preachers. What follows is in no way an attempt to steer you to heaven. The conductor here presumes no such familiarity with the compass heading. It is a simple recital of one man's discovery of friends at a time of desperation. And what he's going to recount is someone who was out here who was able to get a sense of beinghood. And I think it is a message for all of us. The emotional struggles most of us experience largely involve a search for some kind of faith in others, in ourselves, in something higher, protective, and companionable. In this we grope and flail, find, discard, and redefine. My friend has been wrestling his way through this sequence for years and has found himself at various times in the offices of counselors, psychiatrists, ministers, and unclassified wise men. He's found himself in church and in counter sessions as part of this quest, in the homes of friends. He's not a frantic or flaky guy, merely one who is sometimes disarranged and drifting, which means he's one of the millions of us. He's a creative sort, professionally, whose work has amused and informed us on TV and radio for years. He is subject occasionally to a form of seizure. It is brief but eruptive. He may be free of it for more than a year at a time, but when it happens, it plunges him into a horror so deep he believes that he is about to be destroyed. His pain and despair are that acute. He is going to die. At this moment, in fury and grief, he seeks release violently, not against another person, but against whatever else is available. He has smashed his fist through the window, kicked out a TV set. He's emerged from it to discover his arms bleeding and his living room in chaos. A few days ago, it reoccurred. He was alone, so there was no one to restrain him, to make a telephone call, or to understand his agony. He was going to have to fight his way through it, and as the terror began smothering him, he felt the screams in his throat and the hopelessness in his brain. He thrashed for anything that would help him, and his hand touched a Bible on his bedstand. Aimlessly, his hand ran through the pages. He read from a place where they stopped. He didn't really comprehend the words because his mind was in a turmoil. So wild, he could barely summon the discipline to read the words mechanically without regard to their meaning. He read from the 116th Psalm. I love the Lord because he hears me. He listens to my prayers. He listens to me every time I call to him. The danger of death was all around me. The horrors of the grave closed in on me. I was filled with fear and anxiety. Then I called to the Lord. I beg you, Lord, save me. And later he read, he stopped my tears and kept me from defeat. I kept on believing, even when I said I am completely crushed. Even when I'm afraid and said no one can be trusted. My friend said he did nothing more than mouth the words. But his turmoil ended when he finished. He smashed no windows, kicked out no television sets. He calmed down and clear-headed again, found himself sitting down with the 116th Psalm. My friend knows nothing about miracles and doesn't believe this constituted one. Why pin labels on it, he said. Why not just accept? A gift, he said, from something or someone. So why not accept?